Hi, I'm David Crowe, and this is episode 238 of The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. PRN.fm has voicemail. You can call 862-800-6805. And as well as a message or question for this show, leave your name and indicate that the question is for The Infectious Myth. If you dial either of these numbers, long-distance charges may apply. Remember that I don't know your listener till I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift, one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. I do really love to hear from you. Don't be shy. You can make a one-time donation to the expenses of the show via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, or you can commit to monthly donations at patreon.com or liberapay.com, where we are also Infectious Myth, one word. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. And on that topic, I'd like to thank Christian, Haikian, Jay, and Martin for their generous Patreon pledges. If you would like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on any topic you think I have an interesting and worthwhile opinion on, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. I realized recently that most of my shows are in one of two categories. One is an expert in a field with a broad understanding, Peter Duesberg and David Rasnick on AIDS and cancer, Chris Exley and Chris Shaw on aluminum toxicity, Wayne Esquire on shaken baby syndrome. And then there are the small-scale stories that illustrate a larger concept, such as how Effie Stillwell defended herself and her husband from accusations of shaken baby syndrome by showing that she and her baby had a rare genetic condition that mimicked the symptoms of shaken baby syndrome. This week's show is in the latter category, a local story shining a spotlight on a global controversy. Today we travel to the small, about 10,000 people, rather hard to find city of Nelson in British Columbia, Canada. Tourists still come to visit because of Steve Martin's 1987 hit movie Roxanne that was shot there, although the movie pretended that Nelson was in Washington State, not Canada. Logging and other resource industries used to power the economy, but tourism has been growing, both because of the culture in the old, well-maintained city center, and because of the mountains and lakes that surround the city that provide many sports and recreation opportunities. But beneath the tranquil and beautiful exterior, trouble lurks. Donna McDonald moved to, you guessed it, Nelson, in 1972, and quickly became involved with the Women's Center, run by what is now called the West Kootenai Women's Association. She volunteered there for many years and was also a member of the collective that published the Images feminist newspaper. Donna's worked in a social nonprofit sector as a newspaper editor and columnist, as a publicist for a book publisher, and as a forest technician and technical writer. In 1988, she was first elected to Nelson City Council, and over the next 25 years served 19 years as a councillor, and afterwards wrote Surviving City Hall, a memoir of that experience. She's currently trying to figure out how to retire. Welcome to the show, Donna.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, it's great to have you with me, and people are probably curious about why we're talking about a small town that doesn't normally get a lot of attention, unless somebody's shooting a movie there. So can you talk a little bit about the history of the Nelson and District or Women's Center? Well, I guess it's called the West Kootenai Women's Association and the Women's Center that they run.
The Nelson Women's Center is actually the oldest rural women's center in Canada that's still operating. And it opened way back in January 1973. That was back in the time of Pierre Trudeau was prime minister at that time, and he was really interested in investing in youth, and so there were all kinds of programs to help youth get involved in their communities and be little community activists. And
Right. That's
what happened in Nelson, was that a woman who had recently moved here looked around and thought, we need a women's center here So she got a small grant to do some research and prove that she was right, which she was. And then she subsequently got another giant grant of $7,600 to operate.
Wow, gold-plated.
to operate a women's center for a year here. So that was the beginning of it in 1973.
Can we just clarify something? Because when I first heard about it, I assumed that it was a crisis center. So a woman who's being abused by their partner would go there, but that's not what this provides at all, right?
That's right. It's not a shelter or a transition house. We actually do have a transition house in Nelson, so the center fills other needs besides that.
And can you describe what some of the things are that it does?
Sure. You know, it's been almost 47 years now, so of course the services that it offers have changed over that almost half century as needs and conditions have changed. So as I recall, I was more involved in the early years. There was a lot of a lot of talking, trying to understand what, discrimination against women looked like in our lives, and we planned protests and, all kinds of events, Take Back the Night and International Women's Day. So, and also, abortion rights and birth, I'd forgotten that birth control only became legal in 1967, so.
In Canada.
In Canada, yeah.
Wow.
So that was a pretty new thing. So there were a lot of issues around access to abortion and to birth control, options for childbirth, of course, violence against women is a continuing problem. So there was, a lot of activism, I would say, in the earlier days, more than there is now. I think the change possibly happened in the early 2000s when the provincial government withdrew core funding for women's centers. And so it became more difficult to be activist because you were spending most of your time writing grant applications. And also there were, if you remember, former Prime Minister Harper really tightened the activism that registered charities could do and made them, really restricted that activity. And so,
right, I remember some financial investigations into charities and scared a lot of charities. Better not do anything that will annoy the federal or provincial governments, or you might get cut off entirely.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, you could spend 10% of your budget on sort of lobbying activities. So right. I think those two things kind of changed. And also I think that, the increasing needs of women just for the simple basics of life. So I think those three things came together and made it so that the Women's Center focused more on, meeting real needs of women. So having free food, having free clothing, doing like cooking classes, for heaven's sake, at a feminist women's center. But girls' empowerment movement and a lot of programs and activities, but less activism, I would say.
Right. So that all sounds relatively innocuous. It's good stuff. Mm-hmm. Nobody should be getting upset. I mean, I guess you could get people upset at both ends of the spectrum. Like extreme feminists might say, why are you teaching women to cook? That's just going to turn them into servants. And maybe somebody at the other end, women should be staying in the house, not going out.
Yeah.
but in between, 99% of people would say, yes, if women can cook, that actually helps them become more independent, especially young women. That doesn't sound very controversial.
There's lots of skills. Yeah, I'd say that, really the main controversy around the center over the years was the notion of women-only times. So whether that was the women-only drop-in that was sort of sacrosanct for many years, or the women's festivals that were held annually that were wonderful events, but only women could attend. And so we always got pushback on that. But
okay.
Interestingly, recently, we'll talk more about what's been happening now, but as I've talked to people, both women and men, consistently the response has been, well, of course women still need women-only space. So it's kind of come around. Even the men are starting to recognize now that, yeah, there is some value in that.
When we talked earlier, I was saying that I believe, my observation is that when women have a conversation together, they will talk about things that they wouldn't talk about with men present. A lot of women have had children, things like menstruation. Those are things that women would talk about openly amongst each others, but you get one man in there and that they're not going to talk about it.
Absolutely.
And I mean, there's lots of other things too. I don't like eavesdrop on women's only conversations, but it seems to me that it serves an important function, just like when men go out fishing together or something, right? Their conversations are different, and it's healthy to have that outlet of a single sex time.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, there's something, and I presume it's the same for men. I can only speak for women, really. But there's
yes.
there's a special quality of communication that happens amongst women with other women, and yeah, there's less, you know, we're less guarded. We have a bit more confidence that what we say will be received mm-hmm. and respected, and you know, might just call that a sense of sisterhood that we can come together and talk about these really sometimes very painful and difficult parts of our lives and, mm-hmm. and know that we will be safe in doing that.
Yes. I mean, I think it's true for men too. There's certain things they don't feel comfortable discussing with men, maybe some relationship issues or things like that. It's not always sitting around objectifying women, which some people say. I mean, men do also have serious conversations. But
yes.
But what you're saying is some services at the center were open to both sexes. So what kind of services would those have been?
Generally, over time, it was really restricted to women, and we were quite rigid about that, I would say, in mm-hmm. the early years. In more recent years, there's been a bit of a more of an opening, I think, and so there's been some, but really, based on my research anyway, very few events or programs that were open to men as well. So it would be a special, like a, you know, a solstice party or a, you know, an open house or something like that. Men would be involved. But the key program for women that has been maintained is the drop-in program. And that, until very recently, has been very much restricted to women only.
Right. Okay, so things started to change. You sent me a press release from February of 2018, and you had highlighted some things that obviously you were concerned about, and they looked interesting. And I'll read those, and we can maybe talk about each of them afterwards. The Women's Center is embracing and working to model the values of intersectional feminism and decolonization. The center has a longstanding policy of including all self-identified women. Trans inclusion is a natural expansion on this policy. It says, our work includes reconciliation, reproductive justice, resisting corporate industrial complexes, trans and queer inclusion, and other pressing issues of feminism today. It also said, feminism is for everybody, and we want to involve your voices in the process, and we'll offer several opportunities for community and stakeholder input over the coming weeks. So I'll go through these one at a time, because they're quite diverse things. So first of all, is it true that the center had included self-identified women, and how is a self-identified woman different from a trans woman?
Good question. So again, that, you know, they have been saying that they have this, you know, long-standing policy of self-identified women, but when I actually like went through minutes and looked in some detail at what had been going on, the only thing I could really find that could be considered long-standing was back in 2002, when there was a lesbian group that was meeting, and they chose to include trans women. So that was one group at one time making that decision.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, overall, I can't agree that there has been a long-standing policy, because when I look at the policy manual, when I look at the Constitution and bylaws, it's not there. The mandate clearly in those documents serve and support women.
Right. And do you understand the difference between self-identified women and trans women?
I think that self-identified women is a broader term, so that, for example, you could have a non-binary individual who at different times will identify more as a man or more as a woman. And so that individual
okay.
could come on one of their identifying as a women days and come to the women-only drop-in.
Right, but your memory, your history, your research is that the center was pretty much restricted to biological women, with this one exception you've identified?
Pretty much. I think that there have been trans women, you know, a very small number of trans women who have been part of the Women's Drop-In and the Women's Center. That's been just fine. But again, it's a very small number. So primarily the focus has been on women.
Yeah. Okay, so it also talks about reconciliation, decolonization, and these are indigenous issues. So, you know, did indigenous people feel excluded from the center in the past? Like, was there some need to expand from, say, you know, feminists are often accused of all being white women. So expand from white women to include indigenous people, people of color, et cetera.
Nelson is, or this area, I guess, doesn't have any indigenous communities in it. It was more of an area that was used seasonally by different First Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are indigenous people in the community, but it's not a really large presence, although I'd say it's increasing. They're becoming more visible now. So I don't really think that there was deliberate exclusion of indigenous women. It's certainly not in my experience or knowledge. But, of course, there could be sort of an implied exclusion, you know, how it is if you're, you know, as an indigenous woman, you're looking at the center and it's full of white women and you might feel like, I don't think I'm necessarily welcome here. But that might be a feeling rather than a reality, and it might just reflect the fact that there's just a lot more white women here than there are indigenous women. So
I mean, it could mean that some outreach is beneficial, but doesn't, you know, you're saying that there wasn't, you know, a deliberate policy of excluding indigenous people
certainly not. I think that's, as a friend of mine was saying to me, you know, in rural areas, unlike in large urban areas, we have learned that we need to work together with people. And she was talking about sort of environmentalists and loggers learning how to talk to each other.
Right.
But I think that, you know, it's true in the women's community, too, that there's just, it's a small place and we all have to work together. Whereas in a larger city, it's easier to form the tribes, right, of different subsets of women. But here, it's, you know, again, based on my experience, it's been pretty comfortable and pretty welcoming to all women.
Okay, let's move on to the next thing. We'll get to the big issue multiple genders and things like that at the end of this, but let's deal with some of the smaller issues first. So the statement, feminism is for everybody, like Canada's Prime Minister, Trudeau Jr., Justin Trudeau, famously said he was a feminist, which I guess is the same as saying feminism is for everybody, but what did you interpret that to mean, and did that concern you at all? What did you see that as changing the center?
Well, I agree that feminism is for everybody, but my reading in that press release was that, and therefore, anybody who calls themselves a feminist is welcome at the Women's Center. And again, I have to push back on that a little bit because to me, I want to in some form retain that focus on women and the ability for women-only space. And so if you make it, you know, a really broad statement like that, feminism's for everybody, well, does that mean everybody can come to the center whenever they want?
Yes. That seems like a vague statement that could be interpreted in a million different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the big issue was, well, maybe first, what's your understanding of intersectional feminism?
Well, again, it's a word that's being used a lot, and I would assume that the meaning of it is evolving. But my understanding is that when you deal with a woman who is experiencing, I guess my view is if you're dealing with a woman who's in her life is dealing with trauma and oppression, so that's could be coming from a number of different things that would intersect in her life. So the fact that she's a woman, the fact that she's a woman of color, the fact that she's a woman living in poverty,
a
woman with a disability. So all those things intersect in her. But I think we always thought that way. It doesn't seem to me that it's something really radically new, because we've always recognized that as an individual we are, experiencing all of these intersections that come at us. So, but I think that it's another way that in which they are trying to talk about inclusion, and that we have to include everybody. But you know, again, I would argue that we have always included everybody, maybe not as successfully and as proactively as we could have, but you know, we never sent someone away because she lived in poverty or.
Right, and the fact that you were providing free food and clothing, mm-hmm. that probably wasn't too interesting to the middle-class women in Nelson.
No.
but it implies that it's a woman, maybe a single mom or a woman living in poverty, or a disabled woman who's living on a, you know, some kind of disability mm-hmm. allowance. Those would be the people who would need those free things.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a certain perception that the Women's Center just served, you know, privileged white women, and I would argue strongly against that.
Yeah, well, like I say, they're not lining up for free food and clothing.
No.
They're taking their clothes they wore twice to the, the Goodwill, because they don't want to wear them a third time. Okay, so trans and queer inclusion was included in the press release, and it said that it was a pressing issue of feminism today. So how did you interpret trans and queer inclusion in the context of the Women's Center?
That they were making the case in that press release that it was, you know, sort of something that you had, that was kind of mandatory now, that we had to be inclusive and include all of the so-called, what they call the marginalized genders, that was kind of a moral imperative at this time. And again, I'm not arguing that there isn't a need for doing those things, but my question has been, is it the Women's Center's role to do that? Or what is the center's role in doing that?
Yeah, well, some women have pointed out something that I thought was interesting, is that trans women, biological males who want to live as a woman, feel threatened if, say, they go to a male bathroom. But, and okay, so we could say, well, men should just, like, get used to it and not abuse males who don't conform to gender norms. So if a male walks in with painted fingernails and, you know, sort of traditionally feminine characteristics about them, you know, men should behave themselves. Mm-hmm. The alternative is that those males can go to women's places, whether it's a women's center or sports or washrooms or whatever. And then it's up to women to deal with this. And not only that, but it would mean that there would be no standard for a male being present, right? Like there's no way, how would you tell the difference between a man who just wants to come to the women's center and a genuine trans woman who wants to live as a woman?
Exactly. It's really complex, and I think you kind of nailed that one issue, is that it somehow has fallen to women to be the ones who, you know, open our arms and say, sure, come on in. But, you know, that's great, and we can figure out how to do that, but we also have to recognize that, you know, a lot of women have been traumatized by men, and so depending how at what stage in the transition process the trans woman is, they can appear to be a man, or they can appear to be somewhere in between, or they can appear to be mostly a woman, I just find it really interesting, because it's complex, and there's no point at which you can say okay now we agree you're a woman.
This is, or in the other sense, this is too far. Like, you're clearly not in any sense a woman, and therefore you can't come in, right? Like,
yeah.
who would be policing that, sitting at the door and saying,
exactly.
Okay, you've got a beard, so you cannot come in.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's not a simple matter, but I think we have to figure it out, or we have to figure out how we're going to manage all of this change. Like, if you've got a women's only drop-in, and suddenly there's a male appearing presence there, you know, how do you deal with that? Can you manage that change in some way and work with that? Or do you just say, no, we just, at this time, we just simply cannot allow that? So, you know, there's a lot of options, and that's kind of where we are right now.
I don't want to divert the subject, but I don't know if you've heard about the trouble that J.K. Rowling is in, the author of Harry Potter, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
But one thing that I, you know, her Twitter feed is full of abusive comments from trans rights activists. And I don't know if they're all trans women. There may be some allies who just feel like they want to get in there. But the comments I read are really obscene and abusive, but they are classic. I was very careful to say these are not classic male comments. They are the classic comments of a man who's going to offend other men. Right?
No.
Like, they're way off the end of the spectrum. Very sexualized, very derogatory comments about a woman. And yet these people are supposed to be standing up for males who want to live as women. And it doesn't seem like classic female behavior. It seems like classic toxic male behavior.
Right, right. Although, there's probably, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, we've experienced some of that here, and it has come from women, and I find this really sort of mind-blowing, is how did I, as a, you know, a lifetime feminist, end up being the enemy of trans women?
Well, so you're saying that in I mean, I guess we'll talk about some of this, but there's been quite a bit of controversy and arguments and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But are you saying that some women have been, like, sending obscene messages or swearing at people or whatever, that kind of stuff, or has it mostly been males?
No, it's interesting. A lot of the trans activists aren't trans, it appears to me.
Mm-hmm.
They're supporters and allies. And a lot of them are women. I guess probably they wouldn't be men to a great extent, but and so yeah, it's women who are doing this stuff, and it's really quite appalling.
So in 2018, there was an AGM, or an attempt at an AGM. It sounds like, from what I've read in like newspaper articles, that things kind of went off the rails. So can you describe what happened to sort of bring it to the first stage, and then we'll talk about the second stage of the court action a little bit later.
Okay. So just backing up a bit from the AGM, which was in September of 2018,
mm-hmm.
Earlier that year, in February, was when the board at the time decided to hire a non-binary executive director.
Mm-hmm.
This individual presented as female. You know, they had a baby, and they were chest feeding, and they also had a mustache and a deep voice. So they were, you know, a non-binary, neither male nor female. And for women who were regularly using the center, this came as quite a shock, because they were accustomed to being having that safe sisterhood of women while they were at the center. And some women reacted quite angrily and feeling like their space had been violated.
Mm-hmm.
And other women were afraid, because suddenly there was this male appearing person, and here they were trying to deal with male violence in their lives, and it just made them really uncomfortable. And
but clearly a biological female who is presumably undergoing hormone treatment to become more masculine.
Yes, I guess so. I
mean, that's the only biological explanation. I mean, if she was breastfeeding a baby, she must be a biological female.
Yeah.
And if she has, like, facial hair, that must mean she's on testosterone.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah, just trying to apply some logic.
yeah. So, you know, I think it was quite a shock. And, you know, the press release you were reading from earlier was the announcement of this hiring, and it was sort of the... When I read it, it was kind of like, oh, well, this is quite different. This isn't the Women's Center that I've been familiar with all these years. And I wasn't alone in feeling that, as it turns out. So anyway, you know, at the center, there was pushback, and there were arguments, and, you know, mean things were said all around. The center's response was to ban women from coming to the center. So that was absolutely heartbreaking for some of them who had been, you know, longtime users and volunteers. This was
mm-hmm.
center was their second home. It was where they got food and all those things. I remember seeing an email from one woman who was just, like, at this time of year and was desperate. She was cold. She was hungry. She didn't have any clothes. She was lonely. And it was just like, oh, Lord, this isn't right.
And what were some of the sins that resulted in them being banned? Like, did you find out why these women were banned? Were they just voicing their opposition or any?
As far as I know, they were just going, yeah, voicing their opposition. And no doubt they, you know, probably spoke in anger and said some mean things, and mean things were said back, and it was just a bad situation. And I hold the leadership of the center responsible for that. If you're going to initiate change, you need to plan that, and you need to figure out how you're going to transition that for the people that you're serving, and not just impose it and tell them, well, if you don't like it, your discomfort is no reason for us not to do it. You can just leave.
And that's so, sort of an attitude with extreme activists, and it doesn't matter what end of the spectrum you're on, is like, I have this truth here, and if you have any objection to that, that means you are a terrible person. There's different names, like in this context, maybe you're a transphobe, but there's lots of different names for people who don't completely follow whatever the standard is going to be applied by these rather extreme people.
Yeah, I respect the fact that they are committed to their beliefs and their ideology. But I do not respect how they have tried to impose that on the organization and on the users of the center. So that was kind of how the issue became really public. And as I moved around town and talked to other women, there was a lot of women going, "What the hell? What's going on there?" And so I started looking at, I guess because of my local government experience, I put a lot of stock in the value of having clear policies and bylaws and constitutions. And so I started looking at the Women's Center to see if things had changed, if the mandate had changed, you know, unbeknownst to me. And clearly hadn't. It was basically the same wording from 1973. There'd been some amendments over time, but it was still absolutely clear that the language was, you know, we do this for women, we do that for women, do this for women. So there was no mention of marginalized genders or self-identified women or anything in any of the current legal documents.
And I think this is an important point. Like, I have to say that I think many people are involved with nonprofit societies or political parties or other nonprofit entities. Don't look at the foundational documents. Don't take a lot of care over the foundational documents. As long as everything's going well, they don't really matter. But when things go off the rails, and I was involved in a big battle about 10 years ago that ended up with lawsuits and people getting kicked out and things like that, you know, all of a sudden you realize you should have taken that seriously. But with your local government background, I guess, you know, naturally that was probably one of the first things you thought of.
What's the Constitution say? And you're right. The Women's Center is not an exception in having neglected these documents. And actually, I was talking to an earlier executive director, and I said, "Oh, these bylaws! The bylaws are terrible. How could you let that happen?" And she said, "It didn't matter. You know, everything was going fine." And so it's only when things stop going fine that it really does matter.
Yeah, there's a lesson in there for everybody who's listening, who's involved with a society that could possibly get in trouble in the future, that it's much better to deal with these things before anything bad happens. But of course, human nature being what it is, we wait until there's a crisis.
And also nonprofits are busy writing grant applications all the time.
Yeah, and they're running out volunteer time, and who wants to spend hours researching 25 other constitutions and bylaws to see how you could approve yours? Yeah,
exactly. So I appreciate that, and it's just, you're quite right. It's really hit me now how important these are, even more than before. So then around that time, just after the non-binary executive director was hired, a group of women came together and sort of, like the founder of the Women's Center from 1973 is part of it, you know, current volunteers, and former another executive director. So women who've been involved in one way or another came together to talk about what was going on at the center and to think about how we could try to intervene. And we tried reaching out to the leadership at the center and saying, we're concerned about what's going on. Can we meet with you? They weren't really interested in doing that. We made several overtures that weren't successful. And then the AGM that you mentioned in September, we decided to try to address our concerns there through a process called members' proposals, mm-hmm. where members can bring forward resolutions for discussion. That was like probably the worst night of my life. It was just a horrible, horrible meeting. It went on for over 5 hours. And, there was a point in the meeting where all of the staff and the board members had run out of the room in tears, and the rest of us were sort of left sitting there going, okay, what are we going to do? And then someone would come back. So the meeting kind of went on, but, one of the things that really appalled me was that there was nothing about elections on the agenda, and when one of the women asked, aren't we going to have elections, co-chair responded, oh, we don't have to do that, which just to me was so wrong. I mean, of course you have to have elections. This is an organization that's run by members. Members get to choose their leaders.
They have a word for countries that terminate elections.
Exactly. And the proposals that we had submitted, we were, limited to 200 words under the Societies Act, but they took our proposals and wrote like hundreds of words of very prejudicial and inaccurate commentary
mm-hmm.
going with them, sort of accused saying that these were coming from this group of unhappy white women and we should, shouldn't be listened to kind of thing. So the meeting just kind of fell apart. It was really divisive. There was a lot of anger and frustration. They didn't have a chair for the meeting who knew how to chair a meeting. And so she was one of the first ones to run out of the room in tears because she didn't have a big enough gavel to keep control. And then we went downstairs and they had decided, well, I guess we had voted on it, but to have an Indigenous women's decision-making process for dealing with resolutions and our proposals. And unfortunately, the woman facilitating that was extremely biased and, would tell us, sort of point at us and tell us to be quiet, or when she read out our proposal, she'd kind of go, oh, God, well, that makes a lot of sense, eh? So things like that just kind of continued to build the tension and mm-hmm. and the feeling that this was really a waste of time. And so eventually at about 10:45, a number of us just got up and left the meeting because there was no point.
Right. It wasn't going anywhere.
No. And the feeling, everyone was pretty traumatized. I think everybody who was at that meeting experienced some sort of trauma for sure.
On both sides from the sounds of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So then our group, which we called ourselves the Bread and Roses Collective, sort of thought, well, what are we going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't think of anything else other than to, talk to a lawyer and see what legal recourse that we had. And that was a really tough decision because, everybody kind of disdains the idea of going the legal route, but at some point there's not much choice. And
yes,
lots of women were saying, oh, can't you just get a mediator? Can't you just figure this out? It's like, no, I don't think we can actually.
So mediation works when you have both sides that have some desire to compromise.
Yeah, absolutely.
Doesn't work otherwise.
No. So, so really, and what it boiled down to for our group was that we just simply wanted democracy to be restored to the organization. We wanted members to be making the decisions about the future direction of the center, not this actually unelected little group of leaders who were just imposing their own ideology.
You said something about the board of directors was planning to appoint additional boards of directors, which is part of the not having elections thing.
Yeah.
So they would just pick people they liked to be board of
directors
members?
That's certainly how it appeared. The fact that there was, because there is a provision, of course, in the bylaws that you can appoint directors, but normally you appoint them until the next AGM, and then they
right.
have to stand for election. But in this case, they had been appointed, and that was it. They were just going to continue serving, and there was only, I guess there were five of them at that point, and we assumed they would appoint some more to build up their numbers. And yeah, I mean, that kind of process where, I mean, that's so ingrown where the leadership appoints itself.
It's yes.
so contrary to any notion of democracy.
Yeah, I don't think you have to defend your opinion on that.
No.
there's not too many people who
yeah.
are going to say that that's a healthy,
yeah.
healthy thing. Even if you agree with the current board, like
yeah.
it just gets worse over time. And you may start with good people to start with, but they bring in their hangers-on who get, you know, it gets
mm-hmm.
worse and worse over time.
Mm-hmm.
So you decided to see a lawyer, and then
yeah.
What did the lawyer tell you you could do?
So the lawyer that we spoke with recommended that we do a petition to the Supreme Court of BC. And basically that's a process where you lay out your grievances to the court and ask the court to provide to order remedies to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really around numerous violations of members' rights. So we identified all of those in the petition, and then asked for, you know, the court to order things that would address those. And a lot of them had to do with the conduct of the next AGM, which would happen this past fall.
Right.
So we filed that petition at the end of August. Normally, the other party would respond to the petition, and then it would be presented to a court, and the judge would make a decision. In this case, the Women's Center lawyer, they never actually did respond to our petition, but went right into negotiations between the lawyers. They wouldn't actually meet with us in person, so we were working through our lawyers, and we actually, you know, a lot of it was just really straightforward stuff about how to hold a meeting with
right.
having a good chair and having elections and having anyone be able to run and not have to be screened by the existing board and using Robert's rules and all these really radical things.
Right. That sounds pretty radical.
Yeah, I know. It was crazy. And also asking for documents that as members we have a right to receive. So it was just,
like financial documents mm-hmm. and things like that.
And minutes of meetings.
Right.
All that kind of thing. And so the negotiations continued on, I guess, into sort of mid-November, and it was going pretty well. We actually had agreement on almost everything, and then she said that, you know, her clients weren't really responding to her, giving her direction as quickly as she needed, and ultimately they said, "We're out of here. We don't want to deal with this anymore." So they appointed an interim board, and the previous board resigned. And the interim board then had the opportunity to review the settlement negotiations that had been going on. They approved them and went forward, and they organized the AGM.
Okay, and so, and that resulted in a legal document called a
mm-hmm.
consent order.
Correct.
So the judge in the case blessed this and said, yes, this is what's going to control
yes.
the society and the meeting.
Correct.
I was surprised that you went directly to the Supreme Court of British Columbia. I guess that's what you have to do in this kind of case.
I guess so, but we were just following our lawyer's direction. But yeah, it was definitely a BC Supreme Court.
I mean, that just seems, for sort of a small local organization to end up in the Supreme Court seems a bit surprising.
Yeah.
But in this case, it kind of worked. So some of the things that I read that were changed in the meeting... As you mentioned, the consent order controlled the conduct of the meeting and the board elections, you know, the use of Robert rules mm-hmm. defined who would chair the meeting. And I think it also said that somebody who knew Robert rules would be there to make sure there were no disputes about how the meeting should be run.
Right.
That it allowed members to approve board members, i.e. elections,
mm-hmm.
Stuff around financial controls and reporting. Even how the meeting would be advertised,
mm-hmm.
and also gave a copy of the membership list to yourself and one other woman,
mm-hmm.
And then there's also the issue of reinstating banned women. So I think we've sort of been through the conduct of the meeting, and I think most people know how a decent meeting is run and elections. Why was it important to state how the meeting should be advertised?
Because the bylaws are silent, and so we wanted to just make sure that it was advertised well enough and, you know, early enough. And, you know, and one of the things about the advertising of the agenda, the provision of the agenda to members, was that they, the center was not allowed to do what they did last year and add all their commentary to our proposals.
Right.
They were to circulate the proposals as submitted by us.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that was part of it.
And are the bylaws going to be changed so that there is something that says that, you know, the an annual general meeting needs to be publicized a month in advance and that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
It's going to get added?
Yeah. That was one of our members' proposals, was asking for a review of the constitution and bylaws, and that passed. Whereas last year it didn't pass.
Right.
But sure it passed.
Right.
So,
funny.
Yeah, there will be a review of the bylaws. And there's, you know, there's model bylaws provided by the society's branch here, so they can work from those.
Right. And so the copy of the membership list to yourself and this other woman, like, why was that a controversial issue?
So under the Act, when there are certain allowed reasons that members can have access to the membership list, and one of them is to contact members about members' proposals. And so we had been trying to do that, and a year ago in September, before the last AGM, we had been asking and they refused because they said it was against the privacy of their members, and we complained to the director of companies, the registrar of companies, and he issued an order to them to give us the list within 15 days, and they ignored that. And so we just kept on pushing for it because we just wanted to have the ability to send an email to members simply saying, like, the opportunity to explain our members' proposals to you.
Right, which is
we did this time, and the world did not end.
Yes. I mean, it's like when there is a slate of a board of directors, you know, usually there's some mechanism to get that applicant's position to the membership, whether,
know,
a leaflet gets sent to everybody, or there's a website, or they can contact members directly, or whatever.
Yeah. And this is, you know, we were clearly in compliance with the Act, and it was just, I don't know, they were just hung up on it, and still people... There are women who hate us because we came in and demanded the list of members, and God knows what we were going to do with it.
Yes.
Actually, we were constrained by what the Act said we could do with it. And that's what we did.
Yeah, like if you use that list to sell something to people, you're probably violating the Society's Act, and then you could be sanctioned.
Yeah.
So what about the banned women? Were they able to go to the AGM?
So the interim board actually dealt with that before the AGM, and they lifted all bans.
Okay.
Yeah.
And maybe the policy of banning women will be used less frequently?
Well, that was actually another of our proposals that we brought forward and that was passed, was that they review the process of member discipline and make sure that it's, you know, handled with compassion.
Right, because there are times where... any group or society, that there's a person who has major issues and isn't really safe to have around. But those are pretty exceptional circumstances, one would hope.
Yeah.
And so a new board was elected?
So a new board was elected. So it was an extremely good turnout for the meeting. Lots of the trans community were there, and actually... You know, I would say the room was about 50-50, and that's pretty much how the election went, too. So we've got, there's 11 directors, and 5 of them are, I hate to use language like on our side, but women with the same concerns that we have, and 5 who are more interested in the trans inclusion approach. And so we have 5 and 5, and then 1 who's sort of in the middle, and they're going to be quite challenged as a board because they are meant to operate by consensus.
Right.
And failing consensus at the next meeting, a two-thirds vote. And so if they maintain the hard lines, they're going to be stalemated.
Right. I mean, there's a possibility that there could be some compromise and some good things could come out of this.
I really hope so. And yeah, they've only had one or two meetings so far, so I don't know. I'm not on the board, so I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but I think it's been pretty challenging.
Right. The newspaper reported that during the meeting, one woman used the phrase, women born women. I've also heard the phrase, I use the term biological women sometimes, there's natal women, mm-hmm. And the same for men. Some people felt this was offensive, and why is this?
Apparently, they actually said it was illegal, not just offensive, which I found odd, but someone said that according under the human rights legislation, it's not, you're not allowed. That kind of language is considered exclusionary.
Right.
And so we're not supposed to use it, but
well,
as Nancy said, as she was the one who said that, she's kind of going, well, what am I supposed to call myself? If you don't, you know, if you reject the term cisgender, cis woman, you know, all this language now.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's kind of ironic because if the term cisgender can be opposed over the objections of biological women, mm-hmm. then that shows there's a need for a term that describes a woman who was born a woman. So surely we should have a discussion about what's the mm-hmm. most acceptable way to describe somebody who is biologically female as
right.
opposed to somebody who feels that they're female. So we've been talking for a while. We don't have a lot of time left, but can you, you know, I'm sure you understand that this is part of a much bigger debate that's going on around the world. So is there anything you'd like to say about this debate going forwards?
Yeah. Well, I've learned a lot and I'm still learning, that's for sure. And as with most things these days, there's a lot of different opinions out there. I tend to, at this point anyway, I still tend to see us as a binary species. And, you know, that there are two biological sexes that are, you know, kind of, we've always been that as a
right.
as a species. So those things are imprinted in our, you know, our DNA, our anatomy, and
mm-hmm.
all the systems that make us up. So I certainly accept, I have no problem, I have, you know, with people, you know, choosing a different identity. And I, you know, I have friends who are trans, I have friends who are non-binary, and I don't really care, right? As long as they're good people, they can, you know, take on whatever identity they want. I am kind of getting tired of identity politics because I feel like it's serving to separate and divide us much more than it is to support change. But in any case, I think it's a really complex landscape out there, and my hope is that the Women's Center can figure out how we navigate that in our community, in our little here.
Right. I mean, it seems that feminism has kind of been torn in two mm-hmm. Over this issue, and it's going to take some time to put it back together. Otherwise, there's just going to be two warring factions for a long time.
Yeah, and there's you mentioned J.K. Rowling's experience. There's been horrible things said and done here as well against women who are, you know, just asking questions or maybe having a different opinion. And I just find it just so ironic because, you know, the trans activist community are all about inclusion, but it's only inclusion if you agree with them, right? Otherwise, you are out and you are labeled and trashed in many ways. You know, that's certainly been our experience. Clear as we have been about, you know, just wanting to let the members decide to have democracy rule, we are accused of being TERFs and transphobes and racists and violent and all kinds of things. I mean, it's been quite remarkable.
Well, I was commenting today that I have yet to see a gender-critical feminist, which is, you know, the description of women like you who believe that biological sex is still important. Mm-hmm. I've yet to see one of them lashing out violently, you know, with obscene comments, things like that. There's definitely been some anger, but nothing I would say that was, you know, out of line. But some of the trans activists, who are not all trans women, and they certainly don't represent all trans women, mm-hmm. have used the most violent and vile rhetoric, and, you know, photos of blood and T-shirts that say "Kill a TERF today" and stuff like that. Like, there's a lot of violent wording, at least, and I think in a few cases there's been it's mm-hmm. gone beyond that.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, that's, you know, looking at the history of oppressed groups, I guess that's not really unusual. But it seems, I guess, just because we have social media now, it gets to be a lot bigger and a lot more nasty and toxic than just, you know, shouting at your neighbor across the fence, right? It's just a whole different experience.
Well, I guess what our mothers told us as they were trying to socialize us as children, you know, you should be nicer to that to that girl, to that boy.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Don't yell at them. Don't threaten to hit them, right?
Like, yeah, because ultimately it doesn't do any good.
Yeah, we're supposed to get that message when we're like 4 or 5 years old.
Yeah.
But it seems like some people never got that message, and they seem to think that that kind of thing is progressive.
Yeah. I mean, we got a quite a nasty, lengthy letter, and from a local woman accusing us of many things. And Lisa actually took the time to respond and try to provide her some other perspective and information. And the response that Lisa got back was, "You can say whatever you want, but I know who you are."
Right?
Okay. No, you don't, actually. You've never met. But it's that ease with which people jump to judgment and to labeling that I find quite frightening. And I just, this makes me really ultimately very sad, because I think we have so many things that we need to work together on, like, you know, preparing our communities to be resilient against climate change. But this kind of fighting is really harmful.
Well, good luck in your endeavors. I don't think you're on the board, but I know you're a supporter of the organization, and hopefully things calm down and work out, and it provides a space for women to get support, especially women who need the support.
Mm-hmm. I hope so too.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today,
okay,
Donna.
Well,
I really appreciate it.
Thanks for the invitation.
Okay, good to talk to you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Donna asked me to add that the board was mandated by the membership to start an engagement process to try to resolve some of these issues, including how the trans community can be better served. Let's hope it's successful. Thank you for listening to episode 238 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount to Infectious Myth on patreon.com or liberapay.com. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.